Welcome back, folks. We set aside some time every month to visit with the folks from the Port of New Orleans because of the critical role that they play in the economy of not only the state of Louisiana, but obviously the region here, the greater New Orleans region. A lot of very important projects going on. And today we are joined by Port NOLA Vice President of Cargo Development, Amanda Coates, and Paige Carter from the Louisiana Economic Development. She's the Chief Business Development Officer there. Folks, welcome to the show.
Hey, Newell. It's so good to be here. It's such a privilege to discuss our local maritime activities along with Paige at LED. And Paige, I'm sure, wants to say thank you as well.
Absolutely. Amanda, Newell, thanks for having us. Thrilled to be with you all today to share a lot of the momentum and excitement that we're seeing here in the great state of Louisiana.
So you guys collaborate on a number of different things. So why don't we just start with the state of the state. What is the assessment of Louisiana's economic momentum, and how has this partnership played an important role in that?
Absolutely. So the state of Louisiana is seeing wins and excitement that we've truly never seen at the caliber in which we've never seen it. And most importantly, even in areas that we've never seen it. And so under the leadership and the vision of Governor Landry, we've seen over $63 billion choose the state of Louisiana for its next investment. This includes places like Richland Parish, where we're seeing $10 billion from Meta coming into a community that's never seen such investment and creating really the jobs of the future for that area at 500 new jobs, all the way to activity that we're seeing within our existing industries, like Cajun Industries, a long-term community citizen and real strong corporate partner and backbone for the state of Louisiana, expanding its presence all the way into New Iberia. So it's a really phenomenal time to see new companies choosing Louisiana, but even more exciting to see the cultivation and stewardship of our current companies that really make the backbone of the state of Louisiana as strong as it is.
Amanda?
Yeah, the partnership between LED and Louisiana Ports, of course, including the Port of New Orleans, is essential. Our strategies must align. Our teams have worked closely together to foster those synergies, really to accelerate the economic momentum that we have today. We're looking forward to the future, advancing our future in meaningful ways that positively sends ripples of prosperity through generations to come. The Port of New Orleans acts as a vital engine for the state, facilitating trade and attracting businesses to our region. The collaboration with LED has really led to strategic initiatives that enhance that infrastructure, improve our logistics, enhance those existing manufacturers, and attracting new businesses to create family-supporting jobs, from shipping and manufacturing to tourism to technology, and that allows us all to thrive as a state ecosystem.
I guess in both cases, Amanda, you with the port, and obviously Paige with LED, y'all kind of look at things even at the global level, right? Because they have a significant impact, especially for the port. I'm curious, I guess LED, y'all have the same outlook there as well.
Absolutely. We constantly look at our work as how do we fuel and feed the world? How do we ensure that Louisiana-made products and services are really getting the ability to be exported across to global markets? And the Port of New Orleans and LED, we work closely to make sure and make that case for Louisiana, not just as a location, but as a gateway to global markets. Together, like Amanda said, we've identified these high-impact industries that benefit from port access, and aligning on our incentive strategies, our workforce solutions, to really make those deals happen. Because ultimately, Louisiana is and should be the best opportunity for any business to succeed in the U.S.
And it's amazing, Amanda, how much, different products. My wife's family was in the cold storage business, and we used to ship chickens, hot dogs, all kinds of things internationally. People were really surprised as to how much product actually moved through this port in a global way, not just to the United States, and as it related to exports from here. And, you know, I think we even have a greater amount of imports through here, right?
So actually, on our break bulk side, we are importing more cargo than we are exporting. And on the containerized side, and on the containerized side, we have more exports than imports. So exports is, heavy in New Orleans. And as Paige mentioned, we are feeding the world. And so we do see many exports, anything from chicken to, beef. And we're also importing avocados and blueberries and fresh produce, essentially feeding our communities, and that goes into schools. And so we do see quite a bit of temperature-controlled cargo that's moving in and out of the Port of New Orleans. And that has been, you know, a focus of the industry, is continuing that growth. It has slowed somewhat a little bit in terms of infrastructure, building out cold storage facilities, most recently some, tariff impacts. But, overall, we will continue to see global markets growing. And the first thing that people do when they're, when their economies grow, is they eat better. And so we have to continue providing efficient logistics for those countries to be able to receive the exports that are produced here in the United States.
Interestingly, though, just kind of curious in the short term, because some of the tariff deals that have been struck are a guaranteed purchase of agricultural products from the United States in huge numbers. How does that impact you guys?
I think that the impacts are temporary, is what we see. But overall, at the end of the day, the United States is producing so much agriculture, and about 60% of the nation's agriculture is moving through Louisiana ports. And so we see it, as a positive commitment, and that will continue to fuel, ports like the Port of South Louisiana, also the Port of New Orleans, and other ports who are exporting grains and, agricultural items.
To you, Paige Carter with Louisiana Economic Development. She's the Chief Business Development Officer there. What's next for you guys in this collaborative effort? Can you give us some examples of things that y'all are thinking about? Are there things that are changing? And does AI influence any of this?
Absolutely. I think AI is something that we at the department look at its influence and intertwined nature throughout everything that we do. And so whether that's modernizing the local paper mill, or maybe modernizing and using AI through our ports for, better quantitative logistics. And we look at that consistently. But I would say what's next for Louisiana is really establishing ourselves as that global gateway and that global location of choice, so that we can continue to, like I said, fuel and feed the world at higher capacities, and that we can continue to see Louisiana be the choice for companies across the world that are looking for that U.S. solution, that we be serving them with the competitive advantages that we have. Importantly, we just launched earlier this spring a new strategic plan, and when you look at that plan, we're hyper-focusing on 7 priority sectors, but ultimately at providing a level of excellence to Louisiana citizens, ensuring that they have high paying and ever-growing wages that they can really be proud of, that we can see thriving regions that are continually capitalizing on new opportunities and growing and innovating into the future, and that we can provide an ease of doing business for those that have been in Louisiana, have been betting on Louisiana for generations. We want to continue to serve them the best that we possibly can and continue to improve that while also recruiting in future industries.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, because we do have headwinds here, right? I mean, know, we've had out-migration, greater than in-migration, a little bit. That's slowing down, which is good. But the trade-offs have not been real positive, and it's going to take these base hits and and doubles, you know, so to use the baseball analogy, because there are not many times where you get to hit home runs, right? And it's chip away at these challenges a little bit at a time. And, you know, and with that, we can pivot to the lit, because the lit is one of those that could be like a triple in using the baseball analogy. Once we're able to get it up and running. So let's talk about the Louisiana International Terminal and where that stands at the present time.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I would say that,
go ahead,
Amanda, you go first. We're both excited on that.
Yep. We are very passionate, very excited about the project. So just to, you know, reverse a little bit and set the stage to talk about how we arrived here. So over two decades ago, the vision for the port and the future was widely known that developing a container terminal south of the Crescent City Connection would be imperative to staying competitive and a player in the global trade market of goods moving by container. You know, sites were identified, navigational approvals guided the way to the site that we purchased at mile marker 83 on the Mississippi River in Violet, Louisiana, located in St. Bernard Parish, which is, of course, part of our jurisdiction. And this terminal will really allow Louisiana's manufacturers and importers to be served through direct port calls, allowing for us to continue to evolve with the vessel sizes that have been growing since the birth of containerization in the 70s. It really just continues to allow us to be a player in the market, and it is ours to lose. And so we are laser focused on LIT and working with LED and seeing how that we can, you know, attract new businesses to support that. We're, you know, have a strategic kind of plan together. We've been laser focused here at the port for many years on growing distribution and imports to really support those exporters.
So,
Amanda really hits the nail on the head, but I would even say that, you know, the baseball analogy, and Lit has the opportunity to be a home run for us. This is a generational investment truly in Louisiana's future, and it represents our state's commitment at becoming the most robust and innovative and dynamic economy in the Southeast. So we're all hands on deck, really looking forward to seeing that come to fruition.
So I had someone who represents the opposition to this from St. Bernard, Mr. DeFada, on the show the other day. He was not very happy with the way the interview went down, because I'm a big proponent of this project, and I've made no bones about it. I've done my homework. I kind of understand the nuances. This is a difficult project. There's a multitude of activities that are moving at their own parallel paths. You know, and the opposition keeps saying that these are claims that are being made about what's going to be done. But, you know, and I challenged him on that term, saying that really these are more than claims. If you look at the road, I think y'all are looking at three different options at the present time. You can't get a permit until you get everything nailed down as to an option. Each option has challenges. Some are going to be easily overcome. Others maybe not so much. But that's the process that you see play out everywhere, that when you have a project of this size, right?
Yeah. So we, you know, this project, like many other major projects, it doesn't come without challenges. And the challenges are opportunities to change the way that we look at things, to change design. We've actually changed our design from very early on. We listened to the community. We listened to the feedback. And that allows us to, you know, drive the narrative forward, and how we communicate with community, local authorities, and those who, you know, frankly want to have a seat at the table in having those conversations and what they want to see in a container terminal downriver. It's important for us to work together so that we see that to fruition. Otherwise, we lose as a state. And, you know, one in five jobs are tied to maritime activities. This is something that absolutely, you know, must happen for us to stay in the global market and for us to continue to thrive as a state in the, you know, global sector of trade and commerce. And so I think that, yeah, you know, it does come with some challenges, but no challenges that can't be overcome with very strategic alignment and thoughtful, you know, decisions that are allowing for cohesiveness of a terminal, of community, of, you know, the states winning through economic impact. So see it as a positive. I mean, I'll have to go back and listen to the opposition.
Because we love
providing
solutions.
I just
think there's a lot of misinformation. It's not as though St. Bernard is not used to port-related activities, right? They have a lot of port-related activities throughout.
Oh, yeah, port-related activities and refineries and...
Yeah, so it was kind of interesting that it was almost as if they were a virgin in that regard. And it's like, I don't understand. You have all kinds of stuff going on in your port. I mean, that's very similar in nature. So it's going to be interesting.
Yes.
I guess some people just are, opposed to most everything. I don't know. I don't know what the issues are. But
St. Bernard Port is a major existing port that's there, and they're moving cargo daily. And then the Violet Docks have been there for many years. And positive for the state. It's ours to lose.
Right. But these are not claims. I mean, y'all are actually moving. And the point I was trying to make with them is that it's not a claim. They're actually moving, as it related to the road where he goes, they don't have any permits. No, because they're not at that point in the process yet.
Right, exactly. So the RPC has identified the lanes. And so the next step will be, moving forward with identifying the lane the lane of choice. And then we move forward in the process of permitting and
acquisition and everything else that goes along. It's not any different than any other port that's been developed in the country. I mean, they've all gone through the same process. And what we know is they've all achieved a level of success that in an attempt to erode away the amount of business that we do here in the Port of New Orleans and the Port of St. Bernard and the Port of South Louisiana. And the list goes on and on and on because it's all about that competitive environment that we find ourselves in. Now, we can sit on status quo and do nothing, and we know there's going to be one thing that's going to be guaranteed. We will be less than. Fair?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more with the status quo statement. And I think that any bold vision will come with opposition. The most important thing we collectively as Team Louisiana can do is ensure that we're communicating effectively with our local communities and really engaging to hear concerns and be able to, your point about misinformation and disinformation is true, and ensuring that when community members and individuals are seeking information, that they have sound sources to quickly access.
No doubt about it, for sure. Amanda Coates and Paige Carter, thank you so much for joining us today. Truly appreciate the insight and the time, and you guys have a great weekend.
Thank you for having us, Newell. We appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
Alrighty. Thanks, Newell.
We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We know that the Bureau of Labor Statistics issues monthly and annual reports on the job opening, and it's called JOLTS, job openings, and my mind just went blank. And Labor Turnover Survey finally came back to me. And we typically visit with Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. And he joins us to kind of tear this thing apart and let us know what it really says. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, my friend. It's been too long, so it's always a pleasure to be back with a good friend.
Absolutely, sir. So a lot of... going back and forth on these reports, as always, right, depending on who's laying it out. So what can we glean from this report?
Yeah, let's put it in context, Newell, because this is kind of data dump week for the federal government. A lot of really important things happening. The cadence of this in this particular week is we get the job openings data on Tuesday. In a normal week, we have jobless claims out today, and then tomorrow, the big kahuna of the month, which is the monthly employment report, which is the one that has the potential to move markets and even perhaps over the series move the Federal Reserve. And so your question about the so-called JOLTS report, which stands for, you know, Washington loves acronyms, it's Job Openings Labor Turnover Survey, really, I think the headline here is a cautious cooling job market, and that's consistent with what we've been seeing for many months now. We saw both job openings and hiring easing in June. This is a little bit of a delayed report. So the data is as of the last day, a business day for the month of June. Neither layoffs nor hiring seem to have much positive momentum. And we know we're in an environment where there's much uncertainty and volatility, and I think many employers don't want to get caught with either too many people on hand, too much headcount. They're also reticent to engage in mass layoffs, and that is the good part of the story. If you boil it all down, this job openings number, when you align it with the number of people who are unemployed, there's a one job opening for every single unemployed job seeker. So 1-to-1 is the ratio there. And when the job market was red hot about 3 years ago, the ratio was 2 jobs open for every unemployed job seeker. So at his news conference, which I attended yesterday, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell really talked about the demand and supply of labor essentially being in pretty good balance. And what's interesting also in the current environment is we've been seeing both legal and illegal immigration coming down. And both of those had been a large source for the labor market in recent years. And so the irony there is that as we have essentially the job market cooling, we also have fewer people coming into the job market, sort of raising their hands and looking for work. And that helps to maintain a lid on the unemployment rate, which recently was at 4.1%.
Mark, there's been some anecdotal stories and or examples and nuances about wage increases as a result of what you just described. Are you seeing that at all?
Wage growth is still above the pace of inflation. And so, you know, for everybody who is making progress in that years-long war, you know, kudos for them. I think typically it's lower paid workers who are making the most progress. And if you look at it from not from a selfish perspective, but from the one where you hope that people who are struggling have a better lot in life, that is good news. But listen, you know, the number one issue, which you know well, in the presidential campaign, at least economically speaking, was inflation. Inflation is not going away. Elevated prices are still very much a fact of our daily lives. And if you look at the consumer price index, essentially where the price levels are, not so much about the recent changes, we're up 24% in that metric since January 2020. So for all the progress, if you want to call it that, with wage growth moderating but not contributing to inflation overall, I think there are a lot of people who'd raise their hands and say, okay, that's fine, but I'd like to have a little more, please.
Yeah, no, I get it. When the Federal Reserve is looking at these numbers, I mean, the debate right now as to whether or not there should be a cut in rates is raging, right? And we had two dissenting votes, which has not happened in a long, long time. There's usually unanimity amongst the governors. What do you attribute all of this to right now at the present time? Why is there this kind of leakage from this unanimous vote that we have grown very accustomed to?
I think, first of all, it's a tough call. And we're dealing with things that are in many ways unprecedented. And there are a number of boxes at the top of that list. One is the level of tariffs is the highest in a century before the Great Depression. The other thing is, essentially, you have the president throwing a lit match into gasoline where he's trying to pressure the Federal Reserve using the bully pulpit. I don't think that's tremendously effective, but that pressure exists nevertheless. And Chairman Powell himself is saying, you know, we are essentially politically vaccinated from what the president is doing, at least in the process. And of course, we know that Chairman Powell only has until next May in this position as chair. So number one, it's a tough call. Number two, we don't really know how it's going to work out. You know, I mean, we're all living and breathing as we're, what, 4 months since the April 2 announcement on the tariffs. But, you know, every day there's a new headline on how tariffs are being adjusted. And so, you know, it's followed the bouncing tariffs ball. And so trying to make predictions about how much more of these costs are going to be actually passed along to consumers is extremely difficult. And essentially what Chairman Powell described, which I think is a good way of putting it, is there are problems with moving too early on both sides of the equation, meaning, you know, and one of the things he said, which was kind of remarkable yesterday, was he said, listen, you know, some things that we look at with the inflation data are moving up. And so we didn't raise interest rates today. But the other part is that if they were to cut too aggressively or too soon, that could add further fuel to the inflation fire. And they certainly don't want to be in the situation where they're doing a Texas two-step where it's, you know, move rates down and then have to move them back up again.
Mark, what I find interesting about the conversation as it relates to tariffs, it's not as if we've never raised them before, but I've not heard a lot of conversation about the lag, meaning, yeah, you know, at what point in time would we expect to see an impact and how we can go about identifying that? I don't hear many people talking about that at all.
Well, economists are, business leaders are. You just haven't been in those meetings as maybe as much as you were in the past. So you can, if you want to put that on your to-do list, make sure you got your liquor cabinet stocked. But
you know, usually you would think mainstream media, somebody would be talking to folks about this lag and what historically we've experienced, right? I mean, they've mentioned the word lag, but nobody's ever like put chart up there to say, you know, we increased tariffs in 1990, whatever, and this was the lag, and we started to experience, you know, some pressures as a result of the increase in the tariff.
It's a good question and point. I totally agree. I mean, the other part is, frankly, and you know this from your work, is there's only so far you can go on the nuance where people move on and say, okay, what about the Kardashians, right?
So, of utmost importance to everything.
Exactly. But to try to answer the question, the consensus, I think, is that it will happen here in the second half of the year. The level at which it happens, we don't know. And part of the problem is that, as I just mentioned, the tariffs are currently at a level that are the most in a century. It's also the most globalized economy, in a sense, that we've ever experienced. So, you know, it's a little like what do we have that is a historical precedent that we can gauge this against? And the reality is that we don't really. And so to nail it down, if we look at, let's say, what the Federal Reserve looks for in the sense of where the data should be or where they'd like the data to be, the long-term GDP or annualized growth rate for the U.S. is roughly 1.8%, or let's just round it up and say 2. Well, by the end of the year, they think that the impacts from tariffs are going to be enough to move it down closer to 1%, and most economists are in that boat as well. And then with inflation, their target for inflation over the course of the year is essentially 2%. And they think that that's going to move up to 3%. Now, as you know, in this very politically bipolar environment in which we live, where, you know, a whisper becomes yelling in a moment's notice, gets amplified, you know, we experienced 9% inflation at the peak here 3 years ago. In the summer of 2022. And so if indeed it's true, we move from 2 to 3, that's not the end of the world, far from it, but it's not where people want it to go. And so to your question, and maybe people might wonder, well, how is this working or why would it work this way? The main reason is because the ports in the country saw a rush of imports coming in to try to head off or get ahead of the tariffs. And at some point, those inventories are going to be drawn down, and then they have to start, you know, shipping in earnest again. And with that, then you have to pay the tariffs.
Yeah. And actually, it's funny. We had a, I guess it's called a bill of lading. In my little coffee group this morning, an individual was bringing in goods from overseas. And I think the price of the product itself was about $239. With all the tariffs on and fees on top of it, the price ended up being like $700. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look at it in the breakout that way, and they have each line item and how much, you know, goes to this and how much goes to that, it's like, wow. I mean,
yeah, this well, thing I'm glad is you mentioned tripled that. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that really shows the problem with the lack of targeting on all this, right? Because, you know, you could raise the price of coffee to the point where nobody can afford it, and yet there's still not going to be any capacity to produce it in the United States. Right. And so, you know, that ultimately is the problem with these very broadly applied tariffs is, you know, we can't grow avocados, you know, 12 months a year. You know, we don't have plants that can just all of a sudden ramp up automobile production with the flip of a switch. The same with iPhones. I think we all understand what some of the aspirations of the administration involve. There are some that are head scratchable, such as, you know, very political things, such as, you know, the prosecution of a political figure, or, you know, how are tariffs actually going to resolve drug overdose deaths in this country? That's more complicated. But I think we understand the aspiration. The question is, does the medicine actually help the patient? And that coffee example is a great one, where no, it just means that everybody who wants to get their caffeine is going to have to pay more.
And we're paying a lot now already.
Yeah, exactly.
I think my cup of coffee is like almost $6 every morning.
Yeah. There you go.
And it's not that complex.
You don't have the sugar-free vanilla chai latte?
No, it doesn't take 20 seconds to rattle off what I desire. If they charge by the word, it'd probably be about, you know, a lot more for some of these preferences exactly. that are out there. But as always, we truly appreciate your time, Mark Hamrick, and your insight. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll get you back on a more routine schedule here. Things have been crazy, my friend.
Oh, I hear you. It's always my great pleasure.
Thank you,
pleasure.
Sir.
Thank you.
Truly appreciate it. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. All right, folks, welcome back. I'm sorry. I'm trying to find a couple of things here. Just want to remind you, folks, that we believe in the power of being everywhere. Listen to WWL anytime, anywhere. Get the WWL shows you love. Dave Cohen, Tommy Tucker, myself, Scoot, Sports Talk, and the local content you crave on the Odyssey or the iHeartRadio or TuneIn apps. It's real simple. And if you're ready for some football, by the way, the NFL's annual Hall of Fame game tonight, right? Get ready for the first snap of the season with the Detroit Lions taking on the Los Angeles Chargers in Canton, Ohio. We'll join at kickoff Thursday night, 7 p.m. on the home of the Saints and NFL WWL, and streaming live on the free Odyssey app as well. There's a lot going on in the city. White Linen Night is this weekend, Saturday night. Hopefully the weather holds up. It ought to be a good time for all. They had tens of thousands of people, I think, last year out there. So it's a big, big event. And this kind of really starts, culinary starts tomorrow, I believe, in the city as well, with special offerings at restaurants. They're also going to have special drinks offerings this year as well. So a lot happening, and we'll be going through that. We'll cover some of that again tomorrow as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, folks, when we come back, we're going to visit with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. And we'll talk about the sheriff's office release of Khalil Bryan. We'll talk about also legislation that had passed, and it was a new law that required the sheriff to make notifications in a certain time period and whether or not that was done. I think you're going to be interested to hear how they actually found out that they made this mistake. We'll talk about the district attorney's indictment of Edward Morris III as well. And we've got a number of other issues to talk about with Rafi too. And we'll wrap it up with talking about the Metropolitan Crime Commission's Excellence in Law Enforcement Awards luncheon. So stay with us. We will be right back.